Welcome to the Litigation Finance Podcast. I'm your host, John Freund. This podcast is brought to you by the Litigation Finance Journal, the only dedicated news source to the litigation finance industry. Please visit www.litigationfinancejournal.com. Our guests today are David Kirstein and Will Mara. David is Chief Risk Officer at Validity Finance, and Will is Portfolio Counsel, also Validity Finance. Validity is hosting a complimentary webinar this Tuesday, March 31st, titled Understanding the Latest NYC Bar Report on Litigation Funding. David and Will, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Okay, let's start with some background first. The Working Group on Litigation Funding issued a response to the NYC Bar's recent opinion that litigation funding between funders and law firms, that violates the prohibition on fee sharing. So I want to start with this. The NYC Bar's opinion, this was an advisory opinion, right? It was not legally binding. So can you explain what the ramifications of that opinion were? What are the consequences? And also, why was it so necessary for the litigation funding industry to respond so formally to it?
Sure. So this is Dave. Well, first, I would emphasize the piece that was in your question, I think, is really the most important, is that it was merely advisory and not legally binding. And it was heavily criticized after it was issued as being really a too narrow reading of the ethical rules and more or less brushed aside precedent that already existed in New York under the case law that found that these sorts of things were permissible and did not violate any rules. But what it did have the effect of doing, it was such an overly formalistic ruling. It was sort of form over substance of what was practically happening in the world of law and litigation finance, and that did not seem to be compromising lawyers' ethical obligations. But what it did do is it made cautious lawyers a little bit gun shy about whether they could take funding, and I think it ended up lengthening the process for some folks when they were looking into getting funding. Now, in the end, I think there were ways to structure funding both before and after that can avoid the problems with the rule. But it sort of was an overly formalistic opinion that complicated decision making for law firms.
Okay, so getting into the working group's report then, the report recommends expressly allowing funding agreements between lawyers and third-party funders. Can you explain the basis? Let's start with the basis for the NYC Bar's original opinion, and then also what's the basis for the working group's response?
Sure. So this is Will. So the New York City Bar opinion 2018-5 concluded that lawyers can enter into financing agreements with litigation funders where the lawyer's future payments to the funder are contingent on the lawyer's receipt of legal fees or on the amount of legal fees received in one or more specific matters. And what the opinion did is it took, as Dave said, a pretty formalistic view. It said you cannot share fees with a non-lawyer, and what's coming in here are legal fees, and what's going out is the lawyer is sharing them with a non-lawyer. And as Dave mentioned, that opinion came under criticism for a couple of reasons. I think one is a lot of lawyers had already been doing portfolio funding. And so people thought, well, wait a second. We've got these New York cases that seem to sanction it. We've been doing it. We recognize that this is beneficial to our clients. So why can't we continue to do it? And second was sort of a very formalistic approach to the rule. And I think one good example of this to dive into the reasoning of the opinion is the reasoning drew a distinction between recourse and non-recourse financing. So litigation finance is non-recourse financing. What that means is that the funder's return comes only from the share of case proceeds. So if the case doesn't succeed, the funder doesn't get a return. Contrasted with recourse, which is, say, a traditional bank loan. Now, law firms have been taking recourse funding for a very long time, and the opinion basically said, well, recourse funding doesn't threaten attorney independence, which is the purpose of Rule 5.4, but non-recourse funding does. And I think a lot of people challenge that reasoning, saying, if anything, recourse funding is going to provide a greater threat to attorney independence, because if the case succeeds, the bank is still going to come calling for the money that's due. So what's interesting is very soon after this opinion is issued, the New York City Bar convenes this working group on litigation finance. It has 25 members, including a former judge, ethicists, academics, lawyers, and funders. And they come out with a recommendation regarding Rule 5.4. There are two competing proposals, but what's important to note is that both proposals, as John said, recommended that the rule explicitly permit funding between lawyers and funders. The working group said the rule should be, quote, revised to reflect contemporary commercial and professional needs and realities. And they said the consensus of the working group, and I'm quoting here, is that lawyers and the clients they serve will benefit if lawyers have less restricted access to funding. There were a couple of minor differences between the two proposals. For example, one of the proposals would have said that the funding can only be used for that specific representation, one specific representation, whereas another proposal would have allowed the funding to be used for general firm needs. But what you come away from with this working group is a strong statement that non-recourse financing directly to a law firm should be permitted. And I think the last point that I'll just make on there is the work group was careful to say, the fact that we're recommending that the rule be explicitly amended doesn't mean that we agree that the rule as currently written prohibits law firm portfolios.
I would just add to that that we believe that both before the working group and after, there were ways to structure portfolios that would not run afoul of Rule 5.4, and that is what we did. That is what we have done when we structure our portfolios, both at our current firm and before, by bundling together multiple cases with non-recourse that have non-recourse components to the funding, and that where the funding is all the collateral for the funding is all contingent fees. And where the return to the funder is capped, shouldn't run afoul of the basic policies behind the rule to begin with.
And I want to ask you about mandatory disclosure, because the report targets mandatory disclosure at both the state and federal level, suggesting that disclosure should apply only on a case-by-case basis and not be mandatory. So we've been covering this for a long time on LFJ. This has long been a part of the litigation funding debate. And I'm sure we'll continue to be a part of the debate. But really, I just want to know, where do you think we stand on this mandatory disclosure issue? You know, I know there's a bill in the Senate right now that's been idling. The courts have mostly rejected disclosure. There's some push going on in various states with some degree of success, varying degrees of success. Who's winning the debate really right now? Do you foresee mandatory disclosure as a real possibility for litigation funding?
So this is Dave again. I think you're right the way you frame the question. There's sort of at least two main avenues to look at, the federal level and the state level. And also to step back for a moment and think about where this all came from. Most of the attempts to change rules or enact legislation to require mandatory disclosure have been driven by the United States Chamber of Commerce, who has long been against litigation funding of sort of any sort. And they started their campaign years ago against funding, often on behalf of sort of their most well-heeled members, large companies who perhaps don't want the playing field leveled, and smaller companies to get access to justice like funding allows. They often would attack the industry by saying that funding encouraged frivolous litigation. And while that's a good soundbite, once you sort of peel back the onion on that and look at how commercial litigation funders usually structure their cases in non-recourse basis, you realize that funders have no incentive to fund or encourage frivolous litigation, and there's no been no evidence that it has created frivolous litigation in the judicial system. And so that talking point wasn't getting a lot of traction. And so they've more or less moved off that talking point now and moved into the, well, sunlight is the best medicine for this, you know, horrible thing, as they characterize it. And thus began the push for mandatory disclosure. The push started at the federal level with an attempt many years ago, or a request that the Federal Rules Committee analyze the rules of civil procedure, and they recommended, the chamber did, that the rules be amended to require for mandatory disclosure. That initial request was sort of swept away and as too premature, and they've renewed that request over the years several times, and the committee is now looking at it in depth, but have thus far, they have thus far concluded that it still remains too early, and they need to gather more information in order to make any conclusions about amending the rules. And they are a very judicious body that moves relatively cautiously, and so I don't anticipate any changes coming out of that on that front in the near future. They then moved to having certain legislators in the Senate introduce proposed legislation that would require mandatory disclosure in certain circumstances, but it's been pretty a wholly partisan effort by Republicans on the Judiciary Committee, and with the way we all know the Senate is structured, it's hard to get partisan legislation through the Senate. Unless there's sort of widespread buy-in. And so we don't anticipate those bills going anywhere in the near future, and especially with the House controlled by the other party, I think it's unlikely that you're going to see a bill out of on the federal level. So then the chamber turned to the state level, and they've had a little bit more success there. As you may be aware, there's at least one state that has enacted legislation requiring mandatory disclosure, and that's the state of Wisconsin. And there have been a number of bills proposed in the context of other regulations that the chamber is pushing for, mostly with respect to consumer funders in other state legislatures. And they haven't had a lot of success there yet, but there are lots of bills pending. And there's a chance for, I think, more legislation on the state level that could be successful in the near future, because it's a little more under the radar, and it's a little harder to sort of fight back against those bills everywhere.
I think that was a great summary, Dave. And the only thing I'd add is that I think the debate about mandatory disclosure needs to be thought of alongside the efforts for case-by-case disclosure that we see. So you have defendants in cases that are seeking disclosure of funding agreements and funding communications during discovery. And what we have in the decisions that confront those arguments is we have an emerging consensus among courts that discovery is improper, typically for one of two independent and adequate grounds. First, that the information sought is not relevant within the meaning of Federal Rule 26B, which permits discovery only of information relevant to a party's claim or defense. Or alternatively, courts rule that even if it's relevant, it's protected from disclosure by the work product doctrine. And once you kind of register that courts are increasingly rejecting these requests for disclosure, I think it has an interesting implication for the requests for mandatory disclosure. Because the proponents of statutes or rules that require mandatory disclosure in all cases are effectively seeking the disclosure of information that courts recognize will be irrelevant and improper subjects of disclosure in almost all cases. So put differently, because you can seek disclosure on a case-by-case basis, a statute requiring mandatory disclosure actually only has bite, only makes a difference in those cases where a court thinks that the funding documents are irrelevant and should not be disclosed. And the final point that I'll add on that is, it's interesting to kind of think about what's animating some of these court decisions, and there's probably a lot of things going on, but I think one point is the following, which is that if you are very wealthy and you are able to finance a case by yourself, or if you are able to secure the services of a lawyer who's able to litigate the case on a full contingency, this disclosure fight is not an issue for you. You don't have to go through the expensive and potentially harmful to your case discovery. It's only with respect then to litigation funding. And so I think courts are saying, do we really want to put litigants that can't afford to bring their own cases to this sort of catch-22 of either not bringing your case at all or only bringing it at the expense of having this very intrusive, costly, and potentially damaging discovery?
That's great, Will. I would just further pile on a little bit and add that it would really be unfair to plaintiffs, and especially less well-heeled plaintiffs, as Will was noting, to enact such a rule. First of all, there's not a similar rule on the defense side that defendants have to disclose all sources of their funding to defend the litigation and where they're getting their resources in order to do so. So it's sort of just taxing the plaintiffs, which is unfair. Secondly, if well-heeled defendants were to be able to figure out every time their adversary was funded, they would also know when their adversary was not funded. And so they'd have an unfair advantage of knowing, when they're able to sort of stomp all over the little guy with the tactics that are sometimes used when there's an imbalance of resources in a litigation.
Yeah, and we'll continue to follow this debate as it unfolds. I want to switch over to the current economic situation, where we seem to be staring down the barrel of a recession at the moment, unfortunately. So given all of this economic uncertainty that we're facing, what should law firms be doing right now to ensure that they can secure funding for their clients' cases?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a difficult question at this time. Obviously, our thoughts and prayers go out to everyone who's afflicted by the virus and those who are on the front lines fighting it and keeping us safe. It's hopefully the toll of this, both health-wise and economically, won't be as bad as some suspect it will be. Validity, fortunately, we're still open for business. We do anticipate that demand for funding will probably increase in the near to medium term. I think there's a couple of ways that law firms and claim holders should probably be thinking ahead. One is with respect to cases that are ongoing. We expect some claim holders might not be able to continue to pay their lawyers if they're currently paying them by the hour, or they might seek to monetize a judgment if the case is, for example, currently on appeal. Alternatively, going forward, as claim holders think about which cases to bring, we expect that if times are tight and people are looking to save money, that they might be looking more than they were, say, in boom times for a funder to come in and bear some of the financial risk.
So in conjunction with the impending recession, there are some direct effects from the self-isolation, the social distancing that's been happening. For example, we're looking at the possibility of long court delays, operational hurdles as people work remotely. So there's been some debate within the funding community right now as to whether this is beneficial for litigation funding or whether it is harmful. On the one hand, obviously time to settlement is longer, so that's not a good thing. However, on the other hand, claimants are going to need access to funds at law firms as well. So I imagine that demand is probably spiking at the moment. How do you foresee the current environment impacting the litigation funding sector?
Yeah, this is Dave. You are right. I think we don't just anticipate, but we're actually already seeing a spike in demand, an increase in phone calls and emails that we're getting exploring the use of funding on small and even really grand scales by lawyers and clients who are, looking to utilize the litigation finance as a tool, like I just mentioned before. So we see some increased demand for opportunities, in part because clients may have less capital at their disposal to use for their litigation. As you mentioned in your question, while there are definitely going to be delays in the legal system as we see courts shutting down all over the country during the height of the crisis here, many or perhaps even most funders will structure their arrangements with their counterparties to take into account time and timing, and so that returns will often escalate the longer it takes to resolve a matter and to get repaid. And so funders are in many cases protected by escalating return terms if things take longer. But on the other hand, things taking longer, clients running out of money will likely present additional opportunities for funders to provide capital to help those clients.
Yeah, people have long theorized that stressful economic times will create a boom time for litigation funding. So it appears we're gonna find that out eventually, one way or the other. Final question here. Validity is hosting a complimentary webinar this Tuesday. That's March 31st, 1 p.m. Eastern. You're both on the panel. So what can we expect when we tune in this Tuesday?
Yes, thank you for the plug. You can expect to hear from two people much more knowledgeable and intelligent than we are. We'll also have Brad Wendell, who's a professor at Cornell and was one of the co-authors of the ABA 2020 report on litigation finance, and he's one of the leading experts on litigation funding, as well as Constantine Carides, a partner at Reed Smith, who's going to be able to offer a practicing lawyer's insights on what the New York City Working Group report means for the funding world. So we'll be reviewing the working group's conclusions and talking about what their implications might be going forward.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it. The webinar, again, is this Tuesday, March 31st, 1 p.m. If you're interested, you can visit Litigation Finance Journal's homepage. You can scroll down. There's a post from Validity which has the registration link on it. You can also visit them at their website, www.validity-finance.com. So Will and Dave, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, sharing your thoughts on everything. Definitely a lot going on, so we really appreciate you coming on here.
Thank you so much for having us, and everybody stay safe and healthy.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely, and thank you all for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you next time on the Litigation Finance Podcast.